Each year, it's estimated there are 2 million victims of domestic abuse in England and Wales. And yet fewer than 5% of incidents recorded by police result in conviction. There's a severe lack of confidence in the criminal justice system's ability to protect these victims.
This mother of two found the strength to leave her abusive marriage. Nicole Oliver's divorce was nearly finalized in July of 2007 when her husband shot her to death before turning the gun on himself. Oliver had once said, "He wants to see me dead." Her chilling words are now the title of a report released by the Domestic Violence Homicide Review Panel. It's made up of advocates, attorneys, and law enforcement officials. Their goal, to prevent other victims out there from becoming the latest statistic.
Hi, and welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, criminal behavioural analyst, former New Scotland Yard, director and founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and author of the Dash Risk Assessment Model and the book Policing Domestic Violence. And with me today in the LA studio is...
Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for CBS's Criminal Minds, where Jim Clementi is my colleague, and I have a real interest in real crime and the minds that solve those crimes.
And we are very lucky to be joined by a very special guest.
Hi, everybody. It's Francie Hakes. I am a former state and federal prosecutor and co-host with the aforementioned Jim Clementi of the podcast Best Case, Worst Case, and I'm really excited to join you guys today.
And we're really pleased to have you here. And it's a shame Jim can't be in the studio too, but it's getting pretty warm in here anyway with the three of us and all the equipment. So we're just very happy to have you here, Francie, and I know we're going to have a very interesting conversation.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So we're continuing our talk that we started last week, and this is a hugely encompassing subject. But Laura, do you want to just recap what we talked about last time?
So our loyal listeners will know that last week we discussed the mass shooting that happened in Texas. And this was the one that happened on November the 5th on the Sunday, where the local community was gathered in the church and a gunman went in there with a very clear, methodical plan that he acted out and took the lives of 25 people and also an unborn child. And we wanted to pay homage to the victims and to honour them and bring a human face to them, as we always do on Real Crime Profile. And we also wanted to discuss the psychology of mass shooters, and we went into quite a lot of detail with the links with domestic abuse and coercive control, child abuse and stalking. And we had a great debate with Francie about that, both talking about the UK and the US environment and, you know, what needs to change. And what needs to change is, as we're going to continue to discuss, is things like the attitude and aptitude. And in various law enforcement agencies and workplaces, there has to be leadership to say that domestic abuse and violence of any kind and stalking and child abuse is not right and not appropriate. So we're going to jump back into the conversation. And I know, Lisa, you really wanted to highlight one of our listeners' letters. And of course, we hear from so many people. I still get so many emails from people. And sadly, I can't always get to all of them. But I know you're really keen to tell us about Leanna. So why don't you tell us what she said?
When I read this, my blood pressure goes up so high, you may have to take me to the hospital, because it's just unbelievable. So this is from a listener. It's a listener whose friend is going through this, and we have permission to use this friend. I'm changing the name, obviously, so she can be protected, but we do have her permission. So this is from Leanna, and here she goes. How do I even begin? The year and a half since I was brutally attacked and left for dead, I have been in court, civil and superior court. We were also given a 50B protective order, and there was child support because my husband was charged with criminal contempt of court for over a year of non-payment of child support. So in superior court, we were preparing for a trial. The district attorney said that we would not take a plea, period. At the end of July this year, we had a hearing with Judge W on keeping my daughters out of the courtroom during the trial. The judge said he couldn't decide, so he said, I'll tell you what I will do if we have a trial. I will not give your husband an active sentence. I will give him a split sentence. What? How can the judge do this before even having a trial and a hearing and seeing the evidence? Completely not just. The judge said, you need to come to an agreement on a plea bargain. So I talked with my attorney. After hearing the plea, I said, absolutely not, no deal. We left the day with no deal. The trial was on, so I thought. In August, I ran into the court. I had received a voicemail just a few hours before notifying me that I had to get into court, and I got there just in time to give my statement, a summary of the last 14 years of my life, years of violence, abuse, toxicity. I was an abused woman raising my two precious girls in horribleness. I begged Judge W. to protect my girls from this monster who tried to kill me in front of them and let them have the rest of their childhood in peace. I nailed every point and covered it all. He looked at me with a blank face and carried on, with no care, no heart, no concern. My husband pled guilty to assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill. He was charged with a Class E felony and a suspended felony, assault with a deadly weapon with minors present. He was given a suspended sentence of 24 to 44 months in prison and served 72 days and had 5 years probation. Judge W. gave him a week to turn himself in to the county jail. The judge proceeded with his closing statements, telling me that I should resolve this with my husband and become friends with him because we brought two children into the world. I was not able to respond to this insanity. He just victimized the victim. He had no respect for women. So today, my husband got released from prison. I have a piece of paper as my protection. That's it. We have a custody trial in December. After dealing with the judge, he proceeded to state that he would give my husband visitation rights. And when I was up for renewing our 50B protective order, the judge took my girls off of the protective order. And within 30 minutes, my husband was at my girl's school. He and his girlfriend entered the school illegally, approached my daughter on the playground. She screamed, took off running. The teachers ran to get my girls inside. He ended up inside, caused major havoc at the school, and it traumatized them. They had a warrant for his arrest since he violated my 50B. They caught him. And the judge told the officer to tear up the papers and let him go. My eyes are wide open. The 21st century does not protect women and children. It's a man's world. In this small town, it's who you know, who has the power. I've seen too much. 72 days in prison for pleading guilty to assault with a deadly weapon with intent to kill. You get more time for stealing a check. Almost murdering somebody is no biggie. As two little girls scream for help, and were heard all over the neighborhood, my youngest trying to fight him off, they were left in the street over my bloody body. My husband speeds away. They're left. Oh, let's give this attempted murderer rights with these two little girls. Custody visitation, it's insanity. And our therapist says that they are the main victims. They had to watch it all helplessly at 6 and 7 years of age. Their therapist says that if my husband gets any rights with them, she's not going to be able to put them back together again. So this is our life, our insanity. As a mother, I will never, ever give up fighting and protecting my girls, but I have no faith in the Justice Department, its circus. I'm praying for major strength and wisdom as I push ahead to keep fighting to protect my girls. So, and she also has pictures of herself after being attacked, you know, her bloody head and everything. And I'm just, what do I do with that? Francie, tell me. I mean, there's so many women who've written to us. That's just a small example of the hundreds of emails that we get.
Go. Well, there's a lot of blame to go around here, and none of it on Leanne. None. Leanna. None. First, I blame the district attorney, because if the district attorney let him take a plea and allowed him to get that kind of sentence from the judge, he should be run out of town on a rail. That is most likely, I'm not sure what state this is, but it's most likely an elected position. Probably so is the judge. The media needs to understand what has happened in this case, and those people need to lose their jobs. Because while in this country a defendant has an absolute right to plead guilty, you can't force them to go to trial. But you don't then engage in any kind of plea bargaining where you agree to drop this charge or let them plead to this lesser included kind of offense, which it seems to me must have happened in this case in order for him to get a 72-a-day sentence, because pleading guilty to assault with a deadly weapon should have brought years, years in prison. So I blame the district attorney's office first. Secondly, of course, the judge. And I'm really frightened for her, because here's what this case reminds me of. I'd been a state prosecutor for probably about 3 years. At which point I still considered myself to be seasoned, because at that point I'd already had hundreds of cases and dozens of trials because of the nature of the work. And it was not my case, but I was sitting in trial watching the chief assistant district attorney prosecute a death penalty case in South Georgia in the Daugherty County District Attorney's Office. And the entire interaction between the victim and the offender was caught on a 911 call. The woman tried everything the law allowed to protect herself. Ultimately, she got a restraining order. She had a restraining order against him. The day after he was served with the restraining order, this man picks up a shotgun, which he already had domestic violence convictions and so was not legally entitled to have, and went over to her house where she was with her sister. He broke down the front door, at which point his former girlfriend managed to barricade herself into a bedroom and call 911. That's when the call starts. You can hear shouting. You can hear a gunshot because he shoots her sister. She survives, very grievously wounded, and manages to run out of the house. She is in the bedroom on 911, shouting, screaming, and crying for help. Of course, the police are on their way. You can hear him shouting at her. He knocks the door down, and he shoots her once. She's shot in the leg, and she goes down screaming and crying and pleading for her life. He has absolutely no care, concern, or love for her at all. You hear him rack his shotgun, and you hear the shotgun right as she is screaming. Discharge, and the screaming stops. Because she's been shot in the head and is now dead. You hear her hit the floor. And then you hear him rack his shotgun again and eject the shell, which you hear the shell as it hits the ground. And his last words were, "Who's going to court now, bitch?" I've never forgotten that 911 call. It is one of the most horrific things I have ever had to listen to. And my podcast listeners will know that I am a proponent of the death penalty. Jim is not. We've had a debate about that. Many of our listeners are not. Probably many of yours are not. But I listened to that 911 call, and I knew that that is a man for whom the death penalty was designed. There's no question about his guilt. He's literally on tape murdering her in cold blood for taking out a restraining order against him, for what he considered a slap in the face. She was trying to get her life back.
And separate from him.
And he was not going to have that.
Revenge and rejected and wanted to, you know, have that finality point to make her pay.
That's right. And that's why I worry about Leanna. And so I encourage her and any other listeners in that situation to be very cautious with their own lives. Do everything that they can do to protect themselves from something like that happening, because the police can't get there in time always, and tragedy can happen. And so I worry about her. I hope that, of course, I hope and pray that that does not happened to her, but I'm worried the custody battle, if the judge sees the light and decides that he shouldn't see those girls without supervision or maybe at all, I worry about his response to that. I think she needs to take her anger, which is completely justifiable, at the system and channel it into protection, because she needs to be concerned about her own safety.
But I mean, isn't the judge basically teaching these men, doesn't matter what you do, you can get away with it, and emboldens them to then exercise more.
That's exactly what's happening
about anyone around them. They learn that they don't have to pay, that these lives
don't
matter. That's right. So why would anybody's life matter? And I know that in LA, law enforcement is trying to use that to get more support for domestic violence. If you can link it. Because, you know, the women's life don't matter. But if it means there's going to be a mass shooting and other people are going to be affected, then okay, then we can get behind this.
Well, it talks to training again, you know, and having trained judges and magistrates, and it can be very tough to get before them to train them. But the reaction that that judge had, you know, for me, and obviously we're going from, you know, this account of one of our, one of our listeners, but it talks to the fact that, you know, this is a small town mentality. It talks to the fact that there's probably very little training here. It talks to the fact there's a very old-fashioned view about relationships and rigid and stereotypical gender roles of what is expected of her and what's expected of him. And it completely minimises and downplays her whole experience and blames her in the process and gives him a complete pass on his behaviour. Or you might say, is it a complete pass? He served 72 days. But in the context, does that reflect the crime? Absolutely not. For her, there's an ongoing risk. Absolutely. You know, I would be risk assessing this case. I would get her to have a look at the Dash Risk Checklist website to go and speak to a domestic violence advocate. There will be someone, either specialist within her area, if not to call the domestic violence helpline or hotline as it is here, and talk to a trained advocate, because she definitely needs some specialist advice. And I think that there definitely is an ongoing risk to her and to her children. For now, he probably feels emboldened. You know, he probably feels that, well, nothing really happened. He's got his new girlfriend. But when the wheel comes off with that relationship, and it will, because at a certain point, she may not give him what he seeks in that relationship too. So because he has just learned that he can do whatever he wants to and act with impunity, we will see another pattern happening with the next partner. And so it would be just as well to ensure that, you know, all the evidence of any ongoing behaviour is collected, and to speak to a specialist and to see it as an ongoing pattern of behaviour.
I mean, he barges right onto a school. I mean, to me, this is like a mass shooting just waiting to happen. He has no boundaries.
He has no need to lose that. I mean, at the moment, he is in control. You see, that's the difference. He feels that he has got what he wanted and he's been rewarded for his behaviour. And whilst that's the status quo, it probably remain, that's the case until something changes or triggers in his environment when he's not getting what he wants. But it's the emboldened part. It's his, you know, he's been rewarded in many senses. So he doesn't need to exert control in other areas because he already has it. And that's the thing. The criminal justice system has almost given him that vote of confidence, which for her and her children must feel horrific.
In 2013, about 2,800 Marylanders called the police because of domestic violence. But sometimes those encounters become deadly. For 27 years, the Maryland Network Against Domestic Violence has held an annual memorial service to remember those victims and focus on changing laws to make our state and our homes safer.
Fundamentally, the problem is with society at large, right? So there's a criminal justice issue here, absolutely, especially in this case. But it's also with society at large. Take the case that I was just talking about where the man, you know, blew the woman away on 911. The jury did not impose the death penalty in that case. And this is a South Georgia jury who generally would have imposed the death penalty in a, yeah, in a killing, in a clear murder case. But I believe that the reason they didn't was because it was domestic related, because there was that relationship.
It's and just a domestic. It's only
right,
his
discount.
Partner, his ex-partner. It's,
exactly,
he's not a
right.
risk to anybody else.
No.
Or actually, he is
actually,
a risk.
Of course he is. He's a risk to society at large. Just like I had a case, Jim and I talked about it recently on an episode of our podcast, and I titled it The Man with the Machete. And it's exactly the same thing. A man is dating a much younger woman. She's pregnant. He wants her to get an abortion, and she refuses. And so he starts beating her. She picks up a tiny little 6-inch toy bat to try to defend herself and strikes him in the head, raising a lump on his head. In retaliation, he grabs an old rusty machete and tries to cut her head off. She runs screaming out of the house, grievously wounded, almost lost her arm and her head in and of itself, and he chases her out of the house with a bloody machete over his head, trying to kill her because she had the nerve to say, I don't want to get an abortion. That case went to trial because I was the prosecutor. I didn't offer him a plea bargain. I charged him with attempted murder. The jury acquitted him. They said they thought it was self-defense. And when the foreman of the jury came to my office the next Monday to see me, he said that they thought the man did it, but she was just a dancer, aka a stripper. And so she just really wasn't that important. Of course, and then he asked me on a date.
The foreman of
foreman of the jury.
I mean, completely appropriate behavior. I mean, on both levels. I mean, one,
insane.
A victim's life, you know, there's victims and there's victims. And of course, we do see this in the criminal justice system, and that has to stop. I mean, a victim's life is a victim's life. And him then being completely inappropriate and asking you out, well, that tells me a lot about his psychology and his mental outlook and how he views women in particular.
Well, that's the thing. That's my point, is that you've got two different juries, two different cases, years apart, jurisdictions apart, who are devaluing the women victims simply because they're, I don't know whether it's simply because they're women or because they're women and it's a domestic relationship. Well, you know, we don't really want to get involved in that. That's just something that goes on behind closed doors. And it's absolutely outrageous. And until we as a society track what the DA's office are doing, track what the decisions being made by the judges are, and hold those officials accountable, nothing is going to change.
I'm surprised at that, especially because of the right to life issue within that. I'm just shocked that they wouldn't at least have been on her side on that.
She lost the baby, of course. The attack was horrific. She was wounded terribly. Oh. So he got what he wanted. And he got out of prison. So she had to run around that community knowing that the man who tried to kill her and forced her to lose her baby is still in the community with her.
Right, and not be validated or empowered at all through her own experience. I mean, that's why, you know, victims do just get incredibly angry, as we know. They feel that they don't have a voice, but they also don't have any rights, and it's the perpetrator's rights that are put over and above the victims. And we do see that time and time again. Certainly in the UK, there's a victims law that may well pass through Parliament, and there's a lot more just about to come out in the new domestic violence bill that the Prime Minister is leading on to ensure that victims' rights are entrenched within law. And so there's always a delicate balancing act of being innocent till proven guilty. But I think so much of what we see and hear in the cases you've described, Francie, you know, it's attitude and aptitude. And, you know, within small towns where you've got people, you know, living with each other in the community, and there are these views that women should play a certain role and that some women are more worthy than others. And that men are the breadwinners, and there's this kind of, it's not just casual sexism, it is sexism, it's real rigid gender roles. And again, that's probably to all the cases that we've discussed, you know, the patriarchy theme does run through this. And who does that benefit? Well, it benefits those men who are in power, in those powerful positions. And I've got to say that the judge that you talked about, Lisa, you know, his reaction of just being, well, yes, you have to make your decisions and determinations without emotion. But at the same time, there is still a very clear case that he did try and kill her. And just saying, well, just kiss and make up is just completely inappropriate.
Well, it's revolting. And it brings to mind a case that happened just in the last couple of weeks, has been in the news, where a judge made a ruling that the child of rape, he raped a 12-year-old girl. She got pregnant, had the child. He was put into prison for the rape. When he got out of prison, he was awarded custody, joint custody by that judge of that child that was the child of his rape of the child's mother, which made absolutely no sense. Fortunately, there was a huge public outcry. The judge revisited the decision and has now pulled his custody award and claims that he had no idea the man was a rapist when he awarded him joint custody. But the point I'm making in saying that, Lisa, is that, you know, your writer in has said, Judge, I think you said, Well, what we did on Best Case, Worst Case Facebook page is we identified that judge. I put his address and phone number specifically on there on our Facebook page so that people could write in and call in and register their discontent with his ruling. And I feel like if we are not naming the officials who are public officials who are making these decisions, then we're not going to progress.
So she does name him, and she made her Facebook posting completely public. So it's out there, and I was a little wary to say it on
I understand. I mean, in that particular case, with her posting being public, if she's, you know, the judge, and maybe someone could discover who she is.
Yep.
But it's, and that, and I understand maybe she wants to remain private, or we think it's important for her privacy. But we should know who that judge is, and we should let him know that he is making bad decisions. And maybe if we were able to get people to write and call into that judge's office, he'll make a different decision at the custody trial next month.
It can be a real challenge, though, holding judges to account. And I think about numerous cases in the UK, and one of them was a young woman called Jane Clough who was stalked and murdered by somebody who she'd had a short relationship with. And 9 months after she had given birth, he raped her after she had had the baby. And because it was in front of the baby, that was her first report to police. And the police actually did do a good job. They arrested him. The prosecutor basically decided to charge him with 9 counts of rape and 4 assaults, which is actually a very tough decision around charging, which tells you about the evidence level. But he was put before the court, and the judge, Judge Simon Newell, took a decision to bail him. And that decision about whether you remand or bail someone, there was no representation about the risk that he posed, and it was a high risk case. And unfortunately, Jane, as soon as she heard that he had been bailed, knew that he was going to come for her and kill her. And she kept a diary that said very clearly things like, "No one knows Johnny like I do. It's just a matter of time. He's coming for me. People think I'm paranoid, but no one knows Johnny like I do." And this diary was just so difficult to read. And certainly I've worked with the parents, John and Penny Clough, who are just incredible. They just show such humility and try and change things to ensure no other family goes through what they had to endure. And for Jane, she was not just writing a diary. She actually left her home, moved in with mum and dad, and didn't leave the house for 3 months. Now, she had just had a baby. So, you know, her world had become very small, and she was incredibly isolated because she knew she couldn't go outside because he would find her. And unfortunately, on her second day back to work, after those 3 months, she parks in the hospital car park. She was an A&E nurse. She worked in the emergency department. And he used to work at the hospital too, and he knew exactly where she would park. And he stabbed her 72 times. And he then walked away, leaving her on the ground. And she tried to climb up the car. She was still trying to fight back. And he went back and then slit her throat and silenced her forever, because there was no way that he was going to court on those rape charges. I still struggle with the decision that was made by the judge, as does John and Penny. You know, the fact that of what he had done to Jane, to then bail him, and the fact that there were multiple other women who had said the same things. You know, 9 counts of domestic violence rape is something that should not be taken lightly. And certainly my research shows that 1 in 12 of the offenders I profiled who had committed domestic violence rape were raping outside the home too. So to the point, there's a very clear public protection risk. And he is bailed, and then he kills Jane. And the family have to live with that forever. But there has never been any, even though we did make it very clear about the concern of that judge's decision, but there was never any accountability. And I do think that that is a real problem for judges in particular, when they can make decisions like this that have very serious consequences, and yet every other professional is accountable, and yet they are not.
Tonight at 11, domestic violence turns deadly. For the second time in as many days, Cleveland is dealing with a domestic murder. The first, yesterday, at this Burger King on Cleveland's west side. The second, inside this home along Cloverside. And it was an elderly couple.
One of the real important roles, I think, for listeners, write-in campaigns, election issue campaigns, because legislators can make decisions that take these decisions out of the hands of judges. For example, in Georgia and in federal court, there are certain offenses for which the presumption is you must be held. You cannot get bail. You must be held in prison because the nature of the offense makes you so dangerous that it's too high of a risk to the community. Those offenses should always include violent assaults, attempted murder, terroristic threats, and we really need to consider whether they should include domestic violence assaults as well.
Domestic violence and stalking has to be in there. They are the most dangerous of cases.
I completely agree. And that is the job for, because those crimes generally are not federal. They're generally state and local. Because everyone has a state and local legislator in their jurisdiction, that's our smallest political size in this country is your state senator or your state representative. They're the ones who make laws in your state. Start agitating.
That's right.
To take those bail rights away from those who are violent, to protect people from them.
Right. Why should they have a right to freedom over and above the right to life of victims and others? And that balance, you know, there just isn't one. It's a complete epistemic imbalance to the perpetrator. And that's what needs to stop. And I think, you know, certainly making these links across crime types is really important. And I think this has been a really valuable discussion because we've talked about lots of different cases where actually those links, you know, have not been made. And we like to educate our listeners so that they understand what warning signs and high risk factors look like, but also make the links through our professional experience and help them understand, you know, violence and abuse doesn't happen in a vacuum. It is on a continuum. And that's why it's so important to understand the detail and the nuanced behaviour of what's happening. And violence will escalate as it's repeated. And certainly if people get away with things with impunity and they're reinforced that if they keep doing it, nothing will happen and they keep getting what they want, well, guess what's going to happen? They're just going to carry on and the body count and the victims will multiply and they will just continue their behaviour. And that's why the register that I'm trying to bring in with John Clough and Zoe Dronfield, and we've had Zoe on the show, but John, in particular, the dad of Jane, now, the perpetrator who killed Jane was a serial abuser, multiple girls and women before. And of course, he's not just going to abuse Jane in a vacuum. And that's why we feel so strongly that we should be asking the questions of the perpetrator's behaviour. When we covered Dirty John, it was about his behaviour, not about hers. And the training of professionals, again, is really important so that they ask the right questions and see the behaviour in the right way and as the dangerous type of behaviour that it is.
Well, and one of the other issues I think that we didn't really touch on, but I wanted to just address very quickly, was when it comes to the Texas church shooter, the Air Force's absolute abject and tragic failure to report that conviction to the FBI so that the man would be prohibited from purchasing a gun. Now, just because you're prohibited from purchasing doesn't necessarily mean you're not going to be able to get one. Obviously, they're very available, and lots of convicted criminals do get guns. But you at least want to have that barrier there, that break, if you will, in the chain that may prevent something like this happening again. And I understand there's a review going on, but it's just so important that state, local, federal officials are taking seriously their obligation to report these kinds of offenses so that someone like him cannot easily walk into a gun shop and buy the gun that murders 25 people and an unborn child.
Amen.
Right. And that's, you know, to that point, you know, Sandy Hook, when we think about what happened there, San Bernardino, the two Texas shootings, you know, the common denominator. All these things need to be drawn together, and the workplaces are a very important part to it, because these entitled individuals who really want to feel power and control will gravitate to particular professions, and they will gravitate to law enforcement and the tri-services, the armed forces and so on and so forth. And their behaviour, there will be leakage there. So it's really important that professional work settings have work policies for domestic violence, for when there's victims within workplaces, and there will be, but also for perpetrators when we see that their behaviour, they're acting abusively at home or to others, and that behaviour is held to account. And so that's where you can nip things in the bud.
Well, I'm so glad that we all got together today to talk about this, because we've all been thinking about it and reading about it, and just to be able to talk it out for me has just been great. I'm so grateful to have Francie here to really shed light on a totally different side of this subject that I certainly don't know anything about. And Laura, it's so great to have you back in the flesh.
Good to be here physically rather than being on a screen for the past 5 months.
That's right. And of course, we miss Jim, and he could have added a lot to this conversation too, but he's traveling. But we're going to be talking about all kinds of things in the coming weeks, including sexual predators in Hollywood. We know we have a lot to say about that. There's just a lot of things to get to.
There are so little time, but certainly we've already nudged into it, really, with Harvey Weinstein and everything that's happening in terms of serial abusers. So we will definitely come back and discuss that. And maybe we'll bring Francie in again to have that discussion, because it really is all part and parcel of the same conversation.
Right. And I know that my friend Aisha Tyler would like to be on the podcast as well. And I think that she would have a lot to say about that subject. So there you have it.
Wow, what a great episode that we've just had. And we've had quite a long discussion about lots of different things. So I just want to thank Francie for coming in today on a Sunday and joining us in the studio, and also Lisa as well. And this is Real Crime Profile signing out.
If you like our podcast, there are a few things that you can do. You can take 2 minutes and go to Apple Podcast and leave us a 5-star review. You can also check out all Real Crime Profile offers and promotion and our sponsors in our show notes. Another thing you can do is go over to Facebook and like our Facebook page. And one last thing is, please tell all your friends, family and colleagues about us and spread the Real Crime Profile word. Thank you so much for listening to us. We really appreciate you.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan. Sound engineered by Terrell Parham. Music composed by Simba Tsumba. Logo art by Jim Clementi. Real Crime Profile is produced by XG Productions and distributed by Wondery.
For advice and support if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0203 866 4107, or you can go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline, free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, safety, shelter or counselling, call Genesis, the 24-hour hotline, 214-946-4357, or go on their website www.genesisshelter.org or the domestic violence hotline on 800 799 7233.